Well, so throughout the seminar, I'm envisioning it as being less formal. If this were a talk at a conference, I would not be wearing jeans and I would be wearing a tie, and I would be reading my paper off of a script. But that's not what I'm going to go with here. So form matters. Format matters, as you can tell from the bowls that you're using. Some of you use the plastic bowls that are less insulated. Hopefully it didn't melt under you. And some of you use the paper bowls, which are a bit better. These were left over from the trauma competent caregiver training from last week. So I kind of reappropriated these for use. So hopefully it will be an acceptable way of getting food into your belly. But at this first department seminar, this was actually originally something that I proposed. So the department said, okay, that's a great idea, go for it. Now you do the first one. And I was happy to oblige. But what is the point of a theology department seminar? Well, some departments or study areas at larger universities often find it useful to have sometimes a weekly seminar in their area, and the seminar can be a place where maybe department-specific announcements are made, guest speakers come in and lecture on particular topics. At Stellenbosch, there is a graduate seminar in Old Testament every week, and it's an hour and a half, and the first 45 minutes we would meet and read and translate Hebrew together. And get practice in that, and then we'd have a break, and then somebody would present on a particular topic relevant to their research and what we were doing. Sometimes it'd be from within the department, sometimes from without, but we're not going to do that level of intensity here in terms of a department seminar. We're going to try it once a month to start with, and the idea is to create for us a sense of fellowship and community within the department staff and the department students. Maybe a chance to share some advanced research that doesn't typically wouldn't necessarily come up in a classroom setting. And I think this is significant, which I hope I can achieve today, is to show the integration of research and learning and then how it shapes our faith. So at least for me, that's what today is going to be kind of about. We'll at times be able to hear from professionals in our field or related fields and LCC graduates. And then our final seminar this semester will be where our students who are writing final projects for their minor will be the time when you'll present your research, looking at you, Nora and Nastia. And if we had a student writing thesis this year, then maybe this would also be the thesis defense time as well. So a time when we can all come together and celebrate what we do as a department. So for today, I kind of want to, I'm getting to the point where if I start down an autobiographical tack in my talk, then I actually have too much life to get into a talk. So I have to be very specific now and try not to get off topic. But I want to kind of harken back to give you a window into my thinking on how a Hebrew poetry seminar changed my bass playing. This moment where I was transitioning from seminary, which is a context in which you're training for ministry, into graduate study, which is also at the master's level potentially in the U.S. because of how things work out with seminary, but is a different kind of study than what we would study in seminary. And so in my undergraduate and seminary years at Karen University, it was my first exposure to academic study of the Bible, but it was in a very conservative and confessional context. So we had a doctrinal statement that all the professors adhered to, and it was a specific kind of circumscribed academic study of the Bible. And so once I had finished seminary at that point, Corey and I were deciding, do we go into some sort of full-time ministry, pastoral ministry? Do I go to graduate school? And I don't know if I ever consciously considered anything other than Old Testament. It was always going to be Old Testament if it was graduate school. I don't know why. But or we had talked about, we actually had applied and become candidate members of Wycliffe Bible Translators. And we were thinking of then raising support and doing studies for an MA in Bible translation, and then going down that track, or that track. And at this time, I had also, I had started seminary at a different seminary and then left there because of some theological controversy, and then went back to Karen University, which is here, it's a beautiful liberal arts university in Southeast Pennsylvania. And that switch back to Karen for seminary study was actually a really good move for me, because we had a lot more professors with a lot more time to spend on graduate students than at Westminster, because at Westminster the top level was doctoral students. So that's another thing to think about, just as an aside. The MDiv students were the lowest on the totem pole in terms of attention, and there were so many of us. But at Karen, I could get more specialized attention, and I did two advanced graduate seminars in poetry, or in Hebrew. One was in narrative, the other was in Hebrew poetry.
Ben's going to define MDiv for the good of the
crowd. Oh, MDiv, Master of Divinity. So that's the master's level training that you would get at a seminary. It's typically a 3 or 4 year degree for pastoral ministry or further study. At this point, the graduate seminar that I had, I'll kind of take us into the seminar that I took with a professor on Hebrew poetry. The paper that I wrote, the questions I was asking, the paper that I was that I wrote for that seminar, that I eventually was able to present at a conference, and get it published. But in order to kind of give you a window into this, this is where it's going to get a bit technical. So Vitalia, we'll be leaning on Vitalia to be reading the Hebrew on the screen and everything. So I'm just going to pick on you. So we have to understand a little bit of the basics of Hebrew grammar and the verbal system to understand why I was so intrigued by the alphabetic acrostics. I'll explain what that is in a minute. So in biblical Hebrew, the natural word order, the most natural word order for a sentence is verb, subject, object. And this is in contrast to English, right? We typically say, you know, Benj threw the ball. Benj is the subject, threw is the verb, and the ball is the object. However, like some of the languages that you all speak and have studied, Hebrew is a highly inflected language, and so word order can be varied for emphasis or poesis, for poetic value. And when it occurs other than verb, subject, object, typically it's the first word in the sentence that is being emphasized. Not always, but that's kind of the emphasis is on the word that is fronted. So the natural, here's an example. The natural word order of a particular sentence would be, I have sought you with all of my heart. But the poetic word order that we find in Psalm 119:10, the first half of this line, is with all of my heart, I have sought you. B'chol libi darashticha. Okay? So in this case, the with all of my heart is the phrase that is fronted. It's expressed in this this first word here. Remember, Hebrew reads right to left. So what are alphabetic acrostics? Alphabetic acrostics are poems in the Hebrew scriptures where each poetic line begins with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And there are 8 of these acrostics in the Psalter, 4 in the Book of Lamentations, and 1 in the Book of Proverbs. And some people have suggested that there's a half acrostic in Nahum chapter 1, but I think that's garbage. You go try to find it.
Yeah.
So it's really not there. But so these are the examples. And then 2 of these are particularly interesting because Lamentations 3 and Psalm 119 are super acrostics or mega acrostics, where you have not just one poetic line beginning with the successive letter of the alphabet, but actually in Lamentations 3, it's 3 lines per letter. 3 aleph lines, 3 bay lines, 3 gimel lines. And then Psalm 119, it's 8 lines per letter. And that's why if you notice Psalm 119, it's a very large psalm. Very large. It's the longest chapter in the Bible. It is 8 times 22 verses long because there's 22 verses in the Hebrew alphabet. Okay. So here's a demonstration or an example, Lamentations 1. It has a less common three-line poetic structure. Usually you'll see more of a two-line structure in Hebrew poetry, but three is possible as well. And so this first line begins, Eka, how lonely sits the city that was full of people, and that begins with the letter Aleph. The second verse, the fourth line here, begins with Bako, which is she weeps. That's the second letter. And then the seventh line, which is the verse 3, Judah has gone into exile, Galata. And then to just show you a contrast, Lamentations 3, this triple acrostic, has this same letter, begins three lines in a row, Aleph, 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 Beit, 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 Gimel, 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 all the way down. So there's 66 verses, 66 lines and 66 verses in Lamentations 3. Okay. I just took a snapshot of, this is the critical edition of the Hebrew Bible, Biblia Hebraica, Septuagintia, and you don't, only a handful of us can read Hebrew, but you can just see that it's the same letter here that begins lines. This is Lamentations 3. Aleph, 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 Beit, 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 Gimel, 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 Dalet, 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 all the way down. So. Okay, so what's the, that's acrostic form. So Hebrew verbs, if we're thinking in terms of the way that they change or the way that they're formed, they have these components to them. They're a lot more complex than English verbs, and they have these different components that you have to understand in order to read them. You probably don't have to understand them in order to just, you know. Anyway, people who spoke the language didn't think in these terms, they just did it, but they're more complex than English verbs. And they're formed in a way off of what we call triliteral roots. So the root value holds its semantic range of meaning. So this verb, katal, or this root, katal, means to kill. Now you can also adapt these three letters into, there's noun forms as well of verbs or adjectives that are also based on these three letters with different vowel patterns and prefixes and suffixes. So this root katal means to kill. It's the one we always use for the paradigms because each of those three letters are strong letters and they don't change. But it's kind of a nasty, like not a nice word to use for all your verb paradigms. You're thinking all about killing. Sorry. That would be okay, I guess. Pakad is when we learned, right? Pakad, pakada, pakad. So yeah, Vitaly's having flashbacks. So this root then can be added to this root could be added various stems, which have different connotations. There's a passive stem. There's a reflexive stem. Here is the causative stem. So when we add an H sound to the beginning and change the vowels to be I class vowels, then it's hiktil, he caused to kill. So it's makes it causative. And then there's conjugations that. That's, again, not the best word, but that within that stem, then you could have, future or past? Is it infinitive? Is it a participle? And so here I'm going to front the two, or highlight the two indicative forms, which describe things that have happened or are happening or will be, as opposed to other forms which express possibility. Those would be non-indicative forms, or like imperatives. So this would be niktol, which is a prefix form, because you're adding the nun to the beginning, niktol, and that is imperfect. So you might translate this as future or present. We will kill or we kill, and the n is what makes it we, us. Okay. There's also person, number, and gender, although ni is one of those. So katala, katalta is this ending, the ta ending makes it you, masculine singular, you killed, okay? This is the perfect conjugation. And then sometimes you can also add an object suffix. There are other ways to do this in Hebrew, but you add a suffix that makes it as the direct object. So katalni is you killed me.
Katalni. I'm glad it's that rather than you killed in New York.
You killed in NY. That's right. Yeah. Katalni. Okay. Okay. So that's the real quick and dirty summary of Hebrew verbs. Very, very quick and dirty. Michael's like, whoa. There's so much more to say, but that's a very oversimplified. But here's the interesting here was the interesting question for me as I was studying poetry, and the acrostics in particular. The acrostic form, if it's adopted, and we don't know exactly why one would adopt this form, but if it's adopted, the poet then has limited choices for which verbs he or she can lead with if a line begins naturally with a verb.
And yeah. This is because the word order is verb, subject, object.
Typical
verb word order is verb, subject, object.
Right.
Have limited.
Yeah. Right, yeah. No, that's yes. Yeah, right. So that, yes, as a, naturally it would begin with a verb. It doesn't have to, but if it is going to begin with a verb, then you have limited choices. So in the perfect, the katal form, the one where you add letters to the end of a word, then with these stems, the kal, the pl, and the pual, then you can lead with that kind of verb can lead any line in the acrostic, because you can begin a verb with any letter with those forms. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, any of the 22 letters, well, not Vav, but 21 out of 22 letters, you can begin a poetic line with this kind of verb. On the other hand, the other indicative verb, the yiktol form, because it has a prefix by its very nature, it can only occur at the beginning of the lines of four spots in the alphabet acrostic: Aleph, Yod, Nun, and Tav. And then it gets it's a bit more complicated than this, because other stems or forms are also limited in which lines they can appear as the line initial form, as that keyword. So some of them add, by definition, they add a hey at the beginning. Some of them, by definition, add a noon at the beginning. Some of them add a hit at the beginning. So they can only occur in certain spots where there's the de-stem participles. So, given that these two forms, the katal, which we would call potentially call the perfect, which generally describes a more completed action, and the yiktol, which is the imperfect, which would be a not completed action, that these are kind of our two choices if you're going to have an indicative for the verb. Do the alphabetic acrostics in fact prefer the katal form that can occur anywhere in the poem over the yiktol form? And by comparison to other poetry, to other songs, right? And if this is the case, if I investigated and found this, is this merely dictated by the poetic artifice, like the fact that he's chosen the alphabetic acrostic, or is there something about the katal form and its more completed aspect that is more suitable for the meaning of an acrostic poem, perhaps connoting completeness of some kind? This is something that was suggested in the literature. So is it pragmatics? Is it part of the meaning, or is it simply because it's because of the art? Is it part of the is the katal choice part of the meaning that's intended to be conveyed? They chose that verb because that was the best verb for it, or is it because of the poetics meaning? Like, was it chosen because it fit the acrostic? And so the result I found in this MDiv poetry seminar for the paper that I wrote is that the katal, this perfect form, is actually preferred in the acrostics by quite a bit compared to non-acrostic psalms. Those are my two data sets for comparison. All the acrostic poems in the Hebrew Bible, all 12 of them, 13 of them, and then the non-acrostic psalms. I just wanted to limit it to the psalms. And so the katal is actually preferred in the acrostics, and not just in that keyword spot where it fits the poetics, the acrostic form a bit better. So that was what I discovered, and I had all sorts of cool searches in Bible works and Rest in peace, BibleWorks software. So I had all these cool charts and everything, and I thought it was interesting. And so I submitted it to Hebrew Studies, and it got published. So that kind of curiosity about verb choices and that led me to the question of, well, if this acrostic form is adopted, why would you choose this form? Why would you limit yourself in this way, for the sake of, you know, what would be the meaning of this sort of thing? And if you look at all the acrostic poems, they really don't have anything in common with one another. There's one of them is a lament, or it's actually several of them are laments. One is a Torah psalm. One is a psalm of praise. They don't have anything. It's not like they said this is the appropriate form for, or an appropriate acrostic, an appropriate artifice for this kind of poem. So it doesn't seem that is the case. So at this point, I decided to pursue this further and do MTH studies, Master of Theology, which is like a second master's degree, research-based master's, at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, which is beautiful, as you can see. And so the question I wanted to pursue further was, why do Lamentations, these first four chapters of Lamentations, adopt this acrostic form, chapter 3 being that super acrostic? And interestingly, Lamentations 5 has 22 verses. It's shorter than all the others, 22 poetic lines, but it's not an acrostic at all. So it seems like a pseudo-acrostic. Someone is intentionally following this form of the other chapters, but to deliberately resist that form. So what did I discover in this master's thesis, which was then I published it as a smaller article? What I found was that Lamentations, there was a lot more study of Lamentations than I ever thought there was going to be, and especially since the Holocaust. If you think about it, the Holocaust was a moment where people were, especially Jewish biblical scholars, were trying to understand how the Shoah could have happened, and what language could they find in the scriptures and in tradition to express the depth of the suffering and loss that the community had experienced. And what I argued in this thesis and in the article is that this rigid acrostic form is useful in the Book of Lamentations, even though it seems kind of gimmicky to us, because what it does is it provides a rigidity that is then resisted and broken for the sake of, to show you that the community is broken and that things are out of whack. Things are not the way they should be. Okay, so here's this fantastic chart that took me ages to achieve on Microsoft Word back in the day, but I've pasted it here for you. But here's an example of how this works in Lamentations 1, although I do think that this, you can see this in all the other chapters of Lamentations as well. So when we look at Lamentations 1, it goes back and forth between sort of an impartial or an observer who's reflecting on the situation in the destruction of the temple. And daughter Zion is the personification. She's a literary figure, a personification of Jerusalem, of the city of Jerusalem, who has suffered. And so four times in this chapter, daughter Zion says, Re'eh Adonai. She says, look. So that's calling, it's an imperative, and it's calling Yahweh to look and see her situation. Now, Resh, which begins this word, is the 18th letter of the 20th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And so we would expect and it's also one of the most common words that's used in acrostic poems. It's one of the most common words in Hebrew, to see, right? It's one of the most common words that's used in acrostics in line 20 for the Resh line. So if we were going to look in the poem for look and see, Re'eh, v'havita, that's where we would look, is in line 20. But what we see actually is that daughter Zion says it three other times earlier, and each time she's bursting out of place, out of the acrostic form. And I kind of liken it to she's a witness in the courtroom. She's waiting her turn, but then some other witness says something that she just can't let stand. She has, and she just bursts out and says, "No, that's not how it is." And then the judge says, "Order, restrain yourself." But she can't restrain herself. And you can see that she resists the acrostic form by jumping the halfway point, the exact halfway point between verses 1 and 11, and then 12 to 22. We find this right here, but she jumps the gun. She jumps over the halfway mark here and says, "Look and see that I'm despised," and then she continues on in these next five verses. So there's all these instances in Lamentations where the speaker or the subject is the structure is imposed upon the discourse, but then the speaker resists it or breaks it in some way. And I think that there's other features as well that show that things are not as they should be. And what I think is important about this is that it lends credibility to Daughter Zion's stance of protest in the Book of Lamentations, because if you have a witness who genuinely can't control themselves, they're not a very effective witness because they just come to the courtroom and are shouting and screaming and hysterical. But the fact that Daughter Zion, or let's say the author of each of these poems, and using Daughter Zion as a figure within it, is using this very structured, measured artifice that's laid over a lament that has some really, really serious, violent content within it, and seriously theologically explosive content. It lends credibility. This is not a poet who just woke up one day angry at God and decided to write something and just, you know, post it to the internet, right, or tweet it. You know, this is someone who thought long and hard about this artifice, thought long and hard about the suffering of his people, and decided to present these things in this way, and is showing, using this resistance to the form, that things are not the way they should be. And what I found really compelling about this, especially from the perspective of a Christian reader of Scripture, and viewing this as it's a protest against Yahweh, against asking Yahweh, "Have you done this? Have you gone too far? Against whom have you done this? Should you have done this?" This is Yahweh's word to us. So this is Yahweh giving us words to protest against him, right? That's philosophically, theologically, very serious, very, very interesting. And in the book itself, Yahweh doesn't say anything. He doesn't respond. And I like this, let's skip that. This quotation from Kathleen O'Connor, who's written what I think is one of the best books on Lamentations, Lamentations and the Tears of the World. She says, she addresses the silence of God in Lamentations. "If a hypothetical Lamentation 6 had been composed with an answer from God, then," she says, "no matter what God had said, God would say, Lamentations would come to a premature resolution and the book's capacity to house sorrow would dissipate." So God can't speak in Lamentations from that standpoint, because then it wouldn't have the full intended effect of presenting sorrow and anger in this measured but very explosive way. So I think what this led to for me was, during this whole period of study, I had always been involved in music ministry and had done some worship leading, but I came on staff at a church, music staff at a church, and was leading the music for their contemporary style service at a pretty conservative Presbyterian church. And I think that I came to appreciate that there was a deficiency in our worship and what we did in worship, because we had lost lament. So here's a quotation from Brueggemann, which I think is very apt. "The costly loss of lament. Where lament is absent, covenant comes into being only as a celebration of joy and well-being. The greater party, God, is surrounded by subjects who are always yes men and women, from whom never is heard a discouraging word. And I think this is what happens if we, in our worship, if we never incorporate lament, then we're actually kind of denying the reality of the world and how things are not as they should be. We do say in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And that implies that it's not the way, things aren't the way they should be. So I started to see about ways that we could incorporate lament, including the Psalms of Lament, which are a huge portion of the Psalms, individual and communal, and also perhaps imprecations. That's tough. Those are the hateful Psalms, the ones that are curses. How could we incorporate those into worship? That's tough. And Psalms of Confession. It was particularly easier at times when we were celebrating communion, because then that's a moment where we can definitely lament our sins, confess our sins, whether it's in song or in recitation, and then lament. We could speak the words of lament as the words of Jesus calling his Father to look and see, and the New Testament authors do sometimes present Jesus as being the fulfillment of, or the speaker of, Psalms of Lament, notably Psalm 22. So this led me to recognize the deficiency in my musical and liturgical tradition, which I would describe as white, low church, American evangelicalism, the Chris Tomlin, K-Love formula, up to that point. Which K-Love, if you Google K-Love and you see their slogan, it says positive and encouraging. Like, well, laments are not positive and encouraging, but they are roughly half the Psalms. So if we only do positive and encouraging, we're letting half the Psalms go. So this was really fascinating, or fun for me, or challenging, to have to draw on other resources for music and for worship. So thankfully, though, I had some resources. I grew up Messianic in some way, and that's a story for another time. But Messianic Psalms often use scripture itself. They would just sing the Old Testament, and they're often in a minor key. There's a good balance of power and strength that comes from those songs, and also sadness and lament. And one thing that I am thankful for my Messianic upbringing, is an awareness of a church, or of a liturgical calendar that has a development from spring to fall to spring. And that's not something I got in the churches that we attended, which didn't follow the church calendar. But those are, if you have a calendar, a church calendar, then you can recognize that these are times when it's okay for us to be sad or angry or to protest or to confess our sins. And that doesn't negate the joy that comes at other times, but it actually strengthens it and it enhances it. Gospel, jazz, folk traditions, these are all musical traditions that are shaped in part by lament and suffering. And so we were a suburban white church with a few obligatory Korean Presbyterians thrown in, and that we just did not have a very, we didn't know how to do gospel or jazz. But thankfully, we did have some people in our church. There was a professor from Westminster who played jazz on piano quite amazingly, actually. And we did then have some Congolese refugees who started attending our church. And I remember when one of those refugee families died of cancer, and then all the Congolese families from different parts of the country actually assembled in Southeast Pennsylvania at this church, and they were wailing and lamenting over Makangala's death, and there were songs that they sang, and there were things that they said and did that expressed lament that I had never experienced in my tradition. Classic hymns, theological depth, progression through a song and a series of orientation in the first verse, maybe something disorienting in the second verse, and then a reorientation by the end. You can have more complex theological thoughts in a hymn sometimes, especially if it has multiple verses. And that meant also sometimes incorporating choral music, which I enjoyed listening to, but was not at all skilled in directing. Thankfully, we had a solid choral director at our at our church. And I'm married to a choral director. Those weren't the same people, but Corey was involved in the choir at the church, but was also a choral director, is also a choral director. And discovering the historic liturgy, the church calendar, and the common lectionary, which these are all things that force us to engage with lament and sadness, and give voice to these things. I think it's significant to give voice to these things that we do feel, but we don't always have appropriate words. And the great thing is that God gives us words to bring them to him. So we're not just flying off the handle, but they are measured and they are considered. And God gives us this tool to bring them to him. And so how has this changed my bass playing? The medium is, you know, there's just, the medium shapes the message. And being a bassist is more fun when we play messianic and jazz. So I liked this. Music, when you write it, we have guitarists and pianists writing worship tunes. It just feels different and doesn't always, you know, require the musicians to play in concert with one another. The bassist can kind of be pretty lame and just follow along. You know, honestly, they can be kind of boring. Then there was also a desire to reshape some hymns or some songs to be more amenable to playing with a band, with a contemporary style group, make them more bassable. But we also had to come to grips with the fact that some songs are just not suitable for the style or the instruments that I could play. And so that forced me to rely on other musicians in our church, the organists, the choral directors. And I was all for integrating the services. We had these two services where one was contemporary, one was traditional, and never the twain shall meet, or once a year the twain shall meet when we had baptisms or something. And I just think that was such a poor decision when churches, and a lot of American churches, made that decision in the 90s to kind of split off in one direction or the other, because then you end up with two churches. But this sort of direction forced me to rely on other musicians. So, and then for me, it was also important to be testing out the things I was learning in my research by putting them into practice as a worship leader, open to the critique of elders and laity. And this doesn't always end well for the church or for academics, so it has to be done carefully. I have other stories I could tell you about when I feel like this went well and when I feel like this didn't go well. But that's, again, a story for another time. But for me, it was a way, studying Lamentations, which I don't currently work much in Lamentations for my scholarly work, but it was a way, it was for me a first exercise in letting my study add depth to the church's worship. But then worship has to be, reorients us to the God that we are supposed to be serving and examining in our study. Study really does tend to lead us naturally in our sinful state to pride, because it's a way, you know, you're putting your ideas out there and you're saying, my ideas are worth considering. But worship, regular worship, is a way of reorienting us back to the God whose image we reflect. And so if you're not regularly worshiping while you're studying, then, I mean, worshiping as part of your regular life while you're intent on theological study, then your studies are definitely going to lead you awry. I can basically guarantee you that. And I have other stories. And for me, worship was an answer to the problem of suffering and evil. In my own life during that time, first Corey's mom was very sick and almost died, and then her dad was sick and eventually did die, and we were very, you know, he was much beloved, and he was, in a sense, my spiritual father in music and in worship leading. And so worship is an answer to the problem of suffering and evil, because what we're saying is, things are not the way they should be, God, and we're going to sing about it to you. You've told us to do that. But we're confident that somehow you are going to bring redemption out of this, bring something good out of evil. Or that whatever the reason is for the evil that we're experiencing, we don't necessarily know, but we know that you're not ignorant of it, because you've given us words to speak it to you, and in the incarnation, in Jesus Christ, you have experienced the worst of suffering and what this world has to throw at us. So we can never say, that God hasn't, that God doesn't know what we are experiencing. So that was significant. That's significant for me. So you have any questions or comments? That took a little bit longer than I thought it would, but hopefully we have some. Any thoughts or, yeah, I know.
Recently got a comment by a student that Christianity is useless, praying is a form of worship as well, right? As reads how to worship the Lord as well. And so he says all of it is useless and you guys are just using that as a way to pour out your problems and whatever. It's an excuse pretty much. What you're doing, the worship and all of it, that's an excuse for your other problems.
And cheap therapy.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And I would like to know what you would answer to that.
Well, this is where I think the positive and uplifting leads us to this, can lead to this misunderstanding that worship is just therapeutic, that it's like, oh, I just need to kind of something positive to get me through the day. And not saying that positivity is bad, but sometimes it is a denial of the realities. And so I would encourage, in terms of the personal level with that person, are they just trying to shut you down? Or are they actually interested in knowing what do Christians have to say about the problem of evil and suffering in worship? And do we ever acknowledge the existence of evil and suffering in our worship and presenting this to God? So if we're not able to point to things in our worship, if we're in a community, worshiping community, and we're not able to point to ways that we tell the truth to God about this, then we're probably, or that's probably a fair critique by our friend, well intentioned or not.
That's why the men would be very important.
It strikes me that a lot of the problem that you found was a problem with kind of cultural insularity.
Yes.
And a lot of the solution that you found in different cultures, whether it be Lamentations or Congolese refugees or jazz or something outside of this sort of. So I wonder if you just comment on how culture and encountering God in uncomfortable ways for us might help us.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely true, and that's why SEC is so interesting. And come from different traditions and have different cultural discourses or ways of speaking about God, even different Christian traditions. So what I would encourage, this is a great encouragement for each of us to consider it's like a diet, right? You know, if you have a diet that's specific to a region, and you're just eating rice and beans and you never do any vegetables, and go try some food from a different culture if you can. And then you get a different, you won't be deficient in what rice and beans weren't giving you. And so similarly, each of us here at LCC, our diversity, our cultural diversity here is limited on some level. It's becoming less limited. But most of us come from Eastern Europe or North America. But still, there are differences there that we can take advantage of and learn from the backgrounds of our society. So, maybe Nora, you were talking about possibly examining the canon of songs at your church, and do you emphasize sadder songs or songs that are more about personal guilt, or happier songs or uplifting songs? So, and then where does the, being that it's an evangelical church in a Catholic country with a history of Soviet occupation, authoritarian background, maybe you can look to other authoritarian
other countries that have emerged from authoritarian contexts and say, what kinds of psalms are they drawing from? What kinds of books of the Bible are they reading and using and reflecting on? And use that as a resource, especially in countries where maybe the evangelical witness is much smaller. You know, you just don't have as much history or Bible history to draw upon. A little after 1 o'clock, I don't want to cut things off, but I also want to be respectful. So I wasn't as respectful as I should have been. I probably went on a little longer, but I'm happy to keep talking and we can have some more food, but I know some of us do have to go to class. So.
Let me make some maybe closing announcements.
Yeah.
So this is the first of our series, and of course it's, the particular shape of the event is going to take the personality of the person who's leading it to a significant degree, obviously. So others might go about this in a somewhat different way, but I think that's been a very interesting beginning for us, and to see the journey that Bench has been on in terms of his academic work, but also how it affected his practical ministry. And I think that blending is a really good thing. And I'm going to take 60 seconds to tell one story that relates here. In 1989, my best friend got married, which should have been a great, beautiful occasion. And I flew out to Portland, Oregon, and found him in a deep depression, almost completely immobilized. And I got into the shower that morning thinking that he might not go through with it. And the wedding was that afternoon. And after the wedding, during the honeymoon, he just collapsed completely, ended up being hospitalized. And that whole summer, I really thought I was going to get a call that he had committed suicide. So this was just a wrenching thing for me. I discovered Psalm 13 in that context, which begins, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever?" And this became for me just a huge thing to wrestle with this reality. Now, I'm glad to say that he recovered. They've had a great career together. They're still married. This woman did not, you know, collapse emotionally, which I think would have been the normal thing to do under these circumstances, but God gave her grace, and they've had a great career in ministry. So the Lament Psalms are a huge resource that are underutilized, I would say, in our current environment. I hope you'll be back. I hope you'll give a good report to our other students who weren't here and encourage them also to be part of this for the future.